This is the Simon Dell Show, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
One of the big applications for this is in entertainment and movies. You can actually take that home and have a deeper, longer experience from in that entertainment. We strongly believe real estate is going to be huge.
I want to play Call of Duty and be good at it.
That's a recipe for disaster.
Welcome to episode number 29 of the Simon Dell Show, and thank you very much for coming back and tuning in. If this is your first time listening to us, then where have you been for the other 28 episodes? But welcome all the same. And if you're coming back to listen to us from a previous episode, then thank you for coming back. Now, we have a gentleman on the show today by the name of Dr. Dan Swan, PhD. I don't actually know whether you'd say the Dan or the Doctor and PhD, or it's one or the other. But either way, we have a very, very educated gentleman who is the co-founder of a very, very, very cool piece of software, augmented reality for real estate. It's called Realar, spelt R-E-A-L-A-R. So if you get a chance to go and have a look at that, it's realar.com. It is cool as, and it's going to revolutionize how people visualize new builds, renovations, tower blocks, anything that you want to see in augmented reality. It is pretty cool stuff. He has got a bit of a history in this. He has been involved in all sorts of projects like augmented reality and networking, innovation strategy, software development, all those kind of things. He's been in the ad industry as well. And the marketing industry, and he has he's a doctor of philosophy, believe it or not, from QUT, same place as our Dr. Edwina Luck. So fascinating guy, really interesting to hear what he's doing in the augmented reality space. We talk a lot about the differences between AR and VR and how they're going to affect businesses moving forward in the future. So definitely worth listening to. Patrick is back at the Spin Cycle, and normally and the normal service of about 15 to 20 minutes of abuse and insults has resumed. So don't miss that one, because I know you like to hear Patrick being abused, as we all do for some strange reason. The usual housekeeping: Gilberto, the podcast boss. Apologies straight away to Gilberto, because I'm recording this in my dining room and it sounds very, very echoey, which will annoy the shit out of him. But sorry, Gilberto. The other thing is, please rate and review us on iTunes. Please come and tell us what you think. We'd love to hear that. And finally, if you would like to get in contact with me, then drop me a line at simon@simondell.com or come and find me on LinkedIn. I am Simon Dell. Plus, we actually have our own producer now. So Daniel McGowan, you can look him up on LinkedIn as well. Young guy involved in a startup here in Brisbane as well. Daniel@simondell.com if you're interested in being in the show, on the show, or you know somebody who is interested. Other than that, let us jump straight into the Spin Cycle. Welcome to another edition of the Spin Cycle, and we have back, thankfully, from America, the Adam Sandler of co-hosts. It is Patrick Condren, and also joining us as usual is the Professor Edwina Luck of QUT, who is the Bill Murray of co-hosts.
I saw Bill Murray in LA.
Yeah, I know. I was kind of leading you into that one if you hadn't quite.
Wow, he was just there. I could have reached out and touched him.
Why didn't you touch him?
It was a thrill. It was huge.
We said on last week's episode why you didn't get a selfie. We can't understand why you didn't get a selfie.
Well, it's not a complicated story. The pub where the Premier of Queensland was staying, and I wasn't, has a strict no photos policy.
Oh.
So the celebs go there because they know they're not going to get papped, or, you know, no one in the hotel is going to take a photo of them.
Yeah,
now,
yeah.
Had I been by myself, I would have just taken a photo of him. But because I was travelling with the Premier, I would have ignored the rules. But because I was travelling with the Premier, it made it a little bit more difficult. And part of me thought, while it might be a thrill for me to see Bill Murray, whose career I have watched in many, 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 many movies, it may not be as big a thrill for him to have some big boofy Australian yell out, "That's the fact, Jack," you know, which is a quote from Stripes.
Right.
If I kill all the golfers, they'll lock me up and throw away the key from Caddyshack. So I couldn't.
Yeah. Wow.
But it was still a thrill to see him.
Back to that earlier part of that story, the Premier of Queensland was staying in a pub.
Oh, that's just colloquialism for hotel.
Gotcha. Yeah. Right. I got me confused there for a second.
Yes, that's not hard to do.
No, I know. What's your favourite Bill Murray film, everybody out there?
Oh, got to be Stripes.
Okay.
Eddie?
Although,
Groundhog Day.
Sorry?
Groundhog Day was his worst.
No.
Oh.
Ghostbusters.
I have to go. Ghostbusters, yeah. Ghostbusters. Mm.
See, anyway, but then he started off in Caddyshack. Caddyshack is a classic.
Caddyshack is a good film, yes. It is a good film. I saw a installation from Corona this week, which I thought was quite interesting. So Corona the beer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
As in, yes, the Mexican beer. So they've done this big outdoor campaign for World Oceans Day, and it's this massive kind of guy surfing on the ocean, but it's this installation. So the whole thing is coming out of the billboard and it's creating a huge wave full of plastic and rubbish, with the sign next door to it saying, "This wave of waste contains the average amount of marine plastic pollution found on every 2 miles of beach in the UK." It looks fantastic. And it's
brilliant.
It's been extraordinary. Yeah.
It's been getting a lot of love on Instagram. My question, though, is do we need, and I know this is going to sound harsh, but do we need any more awareness that the oceans are full of shit? And wouldn't it be better if Corona was doing something?
We do.
You think?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
because
absolutely.
People see
absolutely.
It, but they don't do anything about it. It's about this behavioural change that's not happening because there's still so many people polluting and with plastic straws and plastic bottles and everything is just, it's not changing people's behaviour.
It's not. And there's, although having said that, I saw a lot of my Facebook ads these days are for shampoo blocks.
I've seen those.
To do away with shampoo bottles.
That was, mm-hmm. I saw that mm-hmm. the other day. That was good.
But you know, there's places, Queensland is banning plastic bags from the 1st of July.
Yeah. Yeah,
so single-use plastic bags will no longer be available in supermarkets. But in markets where that has, those bans have already been put in place, there's been a significant rise in the amount of, prepackaged plastic bags that are sold, the Glad Wraps bags and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So is there a benefit? But big companies are banning plastic forks and plastic spoons and plastic, all that sort of stuff. So I don't think we can do enough.
Agree.
To highlight this stuff. And I think what Corona's doing is admirable, and it really brings it to front of mind for me. And you've got those two Australian blokes that invented a rubbish bin for the ocean.
It's about
the size of a 44-gallon drum that sucks in all the plastic as well.
And there's a lot of people that are doing amazing things with plastic thongs and plastic bottles and plastic everything. And I was reading that the same agency that have done this installation for Corona have also partnered with American Express, and they want to reduce their amount or their use of plastic with and so they're sending out the message to their card holders. So, you know, those guys would be getting a direct mail piece addressed to them. So they'd be looking at this and going, okay, well, how can we change our behaviour? And you could do really amazing direct mail straight into someone's home, and they're looking at how they can reduce what they do.
Isn't direct mail just more rubbish?
Well, it is, but it's still impactful.
It is, but at least it's easier to recycle paper.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, well, it depends where
and
you are.
You've got Malibu in the United States.
Yeah.
The Malibu City Council has banned, you know, plastic straws and stirrers and utensils. Mm. So that's the next step.
Yeah.
Got to be a good thing. Got to be a good thing.
One step at a time.
And the more you highlight this, I mean, you must have all seen the images of those plastic icebergs in the Pacific Ocean.
Oh,
and in fact, the one I saw yesterday, penguins are living on one. It's that big.
Oh.
Penguins are living on this plastic berg.
Mm.
It's disgusting. Yeah. It is truly, truly, truly disgusting.
I'm waiting for that kid. I think he was something like 14.
All power to Corona.
14, 15 years old. He created that thing that they were going to put in the middle of the Atlantic that was going to, like, it was a big machine that was going to just collect all of this up and recycle it. And anyway, I've got a feeling that's close to happening, because apparently he was going to manage to clear it all up in 3 years, 4 years, something like that. But you saw something else as well, Pat, that was kind of, you know, environmentally friendly.
Well, would you shift your finances to a financial institution that didn't lend money or didn't financially support fossil fuel businesses? There's a list in Australia at the moment. The bank MECU, Defence Bank, Bendigo Bank, Members Equity Bank, Beyond Bank, and the People's Choice Credit Union all trumpet their credentials as not lending to fossil fuel organisations. And I think, I don't know that I'd, at this stage of my life, that I would be bothered shifting from where I am, but maybe that's that's something that influences people as well.
What do you reckon, Ed? Convince you to bank somewhere else?
Well, when you think about, yes, it would actually, because I have a daughter who's studying in environmental management, and so she tells me, and she has told me for years about, you know, stuff, greenhouse gas, carbon emissions. She did an assignment on Adani where only one bank supported that, and the big four didn't. So you know. It is, and you know where our superannuation money is invested. That's also another really big story that most of us don't. Well, I'm not going to say don't care about, because there are certain boxes that you can tick and say, yeah, I want an ethical investment. So I think more people are looking at their finances and looking at their organisations and saying, and their banks, and saying, who is more environmental friendly, who is actually, you know, doing what they say? Because a lot of banks for years have said, oh, you know, we're friendly, we've got some corporate social responsibility program, so we've got to have these ads and programs, but who's actually doing it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, I'm not.
I don't think it'd convince me. I've seen the ads. I see the ads regularly because I watch SBS On Demand. They seem to, you know, they push a few ads there, but I think it's a good idea, but I'm not convinced to shift to go through the process of, you know, moving all my financial stuff into another bank just because. But I think if I was starting out, if I was a young person, just starting out and setting myself up, that would be something that influences me, I'd like to think.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. The struggle of moving from one bank to another is enough to put people off these things. If there was something that you could do to kind of switch easier, electricity companies and things like that you could just, you know, tick a box somewhere, and the next day that you wake up with everything's been moved, that would be that would suddenly gear a lot of these banks into change.
You could move
your bank account, like, you know, three times in a month if you wanted to.
Like electricity. I've got two calls.
I can't see any issues with that. That'd be easy peasy.
Can you imagine the paperwork you've got to sign and all that stuff?
Yes. And then they go through the process of trying to convince you to stay by offering you a better deal.
Yeah, I know.
And then you think, well, if you're that keen for me to stay, why didn't you offer me the better deal before I came to you and said I'm going because you're not offering me the better deal?
Yeah. Yeah, it'd just be nice if the Australian banks weren't all criminals as well. That'd be good. That would be a start.
You can't say that.
Yes, you can.
Can I get sued for that?
Possibly. Because no, it's true.
We've been to IKEA this week as well, Eddie.
I know, how exciting. So IKEA, who have been the most amazing flat pack providers for years, has released a street style inspired clothing line. LA-based designer Chris Stamp. You've heard of him, Pat. I'm sure you own so many of his clothes.
Any relation to Terrence?
No, not at all.
No.
But
do you have to sew the clothes yourself?
No, surprisingly not. But I could imagine, you know, you buy flat packs in furniture, you buy clothes ready to be a size 12 or a size 4. No. So now we have, not only do they sell furniture, rugs, pillows,
meatballs,
food, exactly, they now sell clothes.
I got to say. I looked at them.
I don't buy their furniture. I don't eat their meatballs. I don't care what they do.
Well, I buy their furniture. I was in there on Sunday and saw some of this stuff.
Clothes?
Yeah. And it just felt like, it just really felt like it didn't belong, actually. It kind of felt really alien to the whole IKEA experience. And, you know, there was nothing that sort of made me go, wow, that looks great. Which was a shame.
So was it on every floor? Like sort of couches?
You know when you go into the IKEA and you go up the, well, not all of them, but in the one near us, we go up the escalator and you start your walking experience at the top of that escalator.
The what?
Well, you're walking through IKEA experience.
So it's there.
Yeah, there was a big display there. They dedicated quite a big area to all of this stuff.
I can't see anything online about it.
Really?
Like the website doesn't have any that I can see.
Well, I think it's supposed to be this kind of limited edition cool thing. So I don't think they really want it online. I think it's kind of when you go in you see it in store and you go, wow, that's cool.
Like Big W do. And they've had so much success. And so you can buy a T-shirt for $10, a hat, because everyone needs one here in Queensland, for $7.
Yeah.
And it's definitely limited items.
I don't understand how IKEA thinks they can take this kind of cool street brand and all of a sudden people are going to buy it. I mean, you don't go to IKEA to buy cool stuff, really, do you? Unless I'm missing something.
Well, what do we go to IKEA for?
Functional, cheap pieces of furniture.
That's the royal way. I wouldn't dare go through the doors. But anyway... Well,
I went there to get a kid's kitchen. What has my life become? I went and bought a kid's kitchen on Sunday, which I still haven't put together yet. And if I don't by Thursday, I'm in all sorts of trouble. $120.
Wow.
You've got a T-shirt to go with.
Why Thursday?
My wife and my son are away until Thursday, and I was given till then to put it together.
We've got
what day is it? Tuesday.
Tuesday.
Yeah, you've got Buckley.
We're recording this on a Tuesday.
You have got Buckley.
Get some mates over.
Well, get some.
That's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah.
Get on the
couple of beers.
Get on the piss. What did you buy?
It's like a kid's kitchen, so that they like a play kitchen.
I understand why IKEA are doing this in order to try to attract a different crowd, but I doubt that it would work.
I completely agree.
You've seen the clothes. Are they hip? Are they groovy? Are they
fucking black T-shirt, black cap, and you know, it's nothing that you couldn't go into, you know, another street orientated fashion store in a shopping mall and get, you know, with a recognised brand name. You know, so
look, it may work in LA for this guy Spence, but you know, and they're going to have designers that they're going to hook in and come in and have their little line. Mm. If they had Kanye, maybe that might work.
Hey.
Okay, if they had Pat Condron line,
yeah, Pat Condron fashion guru.
Well, when I was in LA a few days ago, I stumbled across a Fred Segal store.
Is that like Steven Seagal?
I don't know. Yeah. His name was Fred.
Are they related?
So I didn't see Steven Seagal there. But apparently it's very popular.
Fred Segal.
Anyway, I thought if I dropped the Fred Segal name, you'd blokes go, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh,
but
right.
Turns out no one gives a rat's ass, so I'll let that go to, through to the keeper.
You see, just to wrap up tonight, Steven Seagal, you know, what he's not made any good films since Under Siege.
Oh, yes.
I mean, Under Siege was his pièce de résistance.
It was great.
That was a great
film. Why are we talking about him now?
Well, because you met his brother. His brother Fred.
He's much more successful brother.
Yeah. Anyway, well, we're glad to have you back, Pat. It's been like it's been
like a
something.
Funeral procession.
Yeah, I'm actually lost for words.
Not that bad.
Wow.
But, you know.
Nah, Kim really kind of delivers when you're not here.
Does she? What does she deliver? Yeah. Like fedora.
Pizza.
Wit. intellect.
Humour.
actual basic knowledge of the marketing space. all those things, Pat.
Well,
but,
I don't
think
you've
really
got me
to have you back.
Because you don't think you got me involved for any basic idea of the marketing.
I kind of got you involved because I felt guilty of stealing the Spin Cycle name from the show that we did on 4BC. That was pretty much it, really. You know?
Yeah, we don't mention 4BC in this house, scum.
Anyway,
ratings,
thank you very much.
Disasters.
Thank you very much for your contribution this week, and I will see you both next week.
Well, you won't see us actually.
Well, you know what I mean. See you later.
Goodbye.
Bye.
I'm joined today by Dr. Swan, Dr. Dan Swan. I was going to say, Dan, that you're the first doctor we've had on the show, but sadly we have Edwina Luck from QUT on every week.
Right.
She's a doctor as well, although I kind of think her doctor certificate or whatever it is you get when you're a doctor was written on the back of a cigarette packet or something like that. But,
that's how they all are from QUT. So,
Dan Swan has a massive, long list of accomplishments. There we go. It's too early in the morning for me, which we'll go through one by one, hopefully, within this chat. But suffice to say, he's worked on tech startups. He's worked in listed companies. He's been involved in tech acquisitions. He's been around the world and worked in the UK, the US, Australia, obviously. Has a master's degree and a doctor's degree. Still working in startups, and now is the CEO of a fantastic piece of technology that brings augmented reality to real estate agents. So welcome to the show, Dan.
Thanks very much, Simon. Great to be here.
And it's not just real estate agents, is it? That's kind of selling it a little bit short. Do you want to give us a quick kind of 2 minutes about what it is that you're working on?
Yeah, sure. So thanks for having me, Simon. It is a beautiful morning. Reala is a augmented reality that's a platform that's built for real estate. So we're not really just about real estate agents. We're about the whole real estate vertical. So and that's the kind of the wide property market. So Reala is a startup. So we've been forging that since midway through last year. The key thing is it came about with my co-founder and I, Keith, who I'll talk about in a second. We were really tracking the launch of Apple's AR kit, which was in sync with the launch of the iPhone 10 or the iPhone X. So the 10 came out, I think, in November last year. And what that did, that basically brought about AR in a kind of new way, augmented reality on new way, now supported on about 500 million iPhones, smartphones and iPads. So that was really exciting to us. So we started to look at that, and we certainly didn't want to do anything that was too gimmicky. So we really found some ways that were really exciting to us that could work in real estate. So Reala is all about trying to visualize a property, a building, a house on a empty block of land. That's where we're at the moment. We've got a few ambitions to take that a bit deeper into the wider real estate space. But that's essentially what Reala does from in broad strokes.
Well, anybody who wants to have a quick look at it, because it's got a great demo video, if you go to realar.com, that's R-E-A-L-A-R.com, which just, you know, if most people don't realize. But if you go to that, you'll see there's a fantastic video there. And I think pretty much within a couple of minutes, you kind of, you know, you only need to watch it for a couple of minutes and the light bulb comes on and you go, yeah, that shit's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there is a demo there, Real AR. So easy way to remember it is AR for real estate, Real AR. But we're also live in the App Store, of course. That's a free app. So if you go to the Apple App Store, you can download it. There's lots of demo houses, play with it, and suddenly get your head around what augmented reality is on a smartphone, because there's a lot of really exciting stuff in there as well.
We'll come back to talk about the whole AR space a little bit later. The first question I normally ask everybody, just to try and get an understanding a little bit more of your background, was what was your first job? And what the first job that you were actually paid money to do?
I think probably my paper round.
Yeah, I did one of those as well. God, it was torturous, wasn't it? Was it one of those that you were doing like every day, every morning, or once a week thing?
Oh, no, it was every day. It was torturous, horrible. You know, cold northern hemisphere winters. That was my very super first job. My first career job was actually I signed up and joined the army when I was 16.
Okay. How long were you in the army for?
I was only in there for a short stint. I kind of joined the parachute regiment, which is I wanted to jump out of planes. Which I found very, very exciting. And of course, they're sort of pretty much special forces.
just dial that back. See, you were at 16, you wanted to jump out of a plane.
Yes. Yes, for a job.
What? Why?
Well,
what on earth brought that into your head?
Well, it was the quickest way at 16. I just really wanted to get out into work. Back then, I wasn't overly academic. I went to a state school. And it wasn't unhappy at home, but I just, I grew up in the countryside. So I just really wanted to, it's the fastest way I could actually get, a regular pay, a regular salary.
Yeah.
Do something that was really quite exciting and a little bit meaningful and, go see and traveling the world. So, but I quickly realized the realities of it, which were, it was, shooting people is a thing. Yes. And, traveling around the world is a bit of a myth, when it comes to certainly the British Army anyway. But it was all good fun and it gave me a lot of confidence and it was very exciting. But more importantly, what it did, it actually led me to, it was almost a pathway to this job, believe it or not, because I joined... as soon as I left, I joined a company called Raycall, who make things like radars and missiles and lots of other sort of exciting technology. And they had a Skunkworks project in there at the time, which
do you want to just explain what Skunkworks is to people who may not understand?
Yeah, sure. An R&D project, so a little side project that they were sort of playing around and tinkering with. You can imagine these sort of military esque kind of boffins, kind of Q type people, and this side little project was called Vodafone. which was kind of my segue into how I got involved with technology, really. So I was always a bit of a, as well as loving the outdoors, I was always, in those cold winter months, I was always a bit of a computer nerd as well simultaneously. So for me, it sounds ludicrous, but it was actually quite natural to start tinkering around this stuff. So that was my start in life, I suppose.
I noticed that Raycall were actually based in Chessington, which again, for those of you that those people listening from the UK will know from its famous World of Adventures. Was that theme park there at the time? I'm just trying to think when it was actually.
Yeah, no, Chessington Zoo's always been there. So I think it evolved from being just a zoo to being.
Yes, it did, didn't it? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So it was good times. It was fun. But that's pretty much how I kicked off and got my career going. So, you know, it was sort of a bit of a left of field way of getting into startups in a weird way.
I noticed that after that, that you kind of got yourself into web development. And again, I think what I'm interested in understanding is that was web development back in what it says there, 96 to 98.
Mm.
So that's what, 22 years ago.
Mm.
What was web development like 20 years ago?
You know, back then it was really cool.
Are you saying now if you're in web development, you're not cool anymore?
Well, it is kind of cool, but it's I think there are sort of areas of web dev which are cool and interesting. I think, you know, because there are platforms like, you know, Squarespace and Wix and those kind of things, you can just sort of whack it out fairly quickly. So the old school, what we would call a web designer, is, you know, radically different to what we were back then. So, yeah, pretty much, you know, I took off and did a bit of traveling. I came back and decided, actually, I did have a brain and I wanted to use it. So I went to university and studied from 93 to 96. And the upshot of that was universities back then were probably the, in terms of the internet, they were probably the only areas that were, you know, the only institutions that were really doing anything. Yeah. So I actually remember sending my first email to a professor in Australia and using a, you know, kind of green screen kind of command prompt kind of stuff, which was kind of all very interesting. And then just sitting there looking at it, like waiting what happens next. So that was my first email. You know, universities were quite exciting, and lots of, because I'd already had that background experience, you know, with a little bit of tech. And, you know, back then, you know, that was the transition really. My Raycall experience was transitioning from, you know, mainframe computings with big disks and tapes. Suddenly, which actually became a little bit boring for me. Suddenly, the rise of the personal computer, and then the personal computer connected to the internet was all pretty exciting. So, you know, even at university, I was studying what the, you know, the impact of what was then called the sort of the information superhighway would take hold. So it was actually pretty exciting. So I pretty much, as I was leaving university in 96, I'd already started teaching myself things like HTML and VRML, actually, VRML, which is sort of a, you know, a 3D version, which never took off. So I pretty much left university straight away, walking into, you know, having started my own business. And we were doing a lot of work. I was still based in Cambridge at that time. But we were doing a lot of work actually with the property and financial markets in the UK, in around the city of London. So it was really cool. So that was sort of our first area of you know, what we would call being a web dev shop. So we were just, you know, people were, there was a lot of education. I actually had, part of my role was being paid by the government, actually going out and handing grants and telling people what the, you know, what the interweb was. And it was a little bit more than just the yellow pages online. So they were really exciting times in retrospect.
I assume that, and as you just said there, so you can code. Do you still code now? Is that something that you do, or you leave that to somebody else?
I definitely don't code anymore. Okay. for a multitude of reasons. I understand code, so you know, it's a good skill to have, because it means you can understand, you know, the limits of technology. And so, you know, when you whiteboard the blue box and point that to the red box, it, you know, developers don't look at you kind of go, well, that involves, you know, folding time. So it's an important skill to have, and I definitely would encourage anyone out there to go out and learn some coding if you don't already.
So kids coming out of university or school today, that's something that you think, even if that's not a long-term career for them, at least understand how code works.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's kind of like understanding how your car works and,
yeah.
you know, where to put the oil and all that, but obviously a little bit deeper. So, you know, I know HTML, JavaScript and a bit of Java.
Yeah.
You know, was I a good coder? Not at all. There were many more brilliant minds, you know, mathematically around me, but it just meant that I could hold some kind of conversation, at least grasp, you know, some of the wacky ideas that they were talking about. So, yeah, you know, kids coming out of school, go to, you know, and even if you're not going to college or university, jump on things like code.org and teach yourself how to code.
You moved there to a startup, so WebTrack.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that, because I think the interesting thing for me for that was it was 98 to 2002. So there was a bubble bursting at some point in there as well, wasn't there?
Mm, yeah, it was. So, and it's kind of a bit of a segue to where we are now and the reason why we're, and what we're doing with Reela as well. So, excuse me. So, we actually originally created our own little web dev shop. We ran that for probably about 18 months.
When you say we, sorry, who was that? Who are you doing?
Oh, it's a business partner of mine in the UK.
Cool.
Actually,
okay.
a good friend of mine actually from back home.
Gotcha.
And so, you know, we kind of started doing this stuff, and actually through him, he was a, you know, much more of a hardcore gaming coder. So I'd be the guy sort of running around talking to people, customers, that kind of stuff. Anyway, it sort of came to a head. And we were trying to figure out, you know, because we were literally just making it up, because there, you know, web developers weren't really a thing yet.
Yeah.
And the hype hadn't really started in terms of .com boom, certainly in the UK. And so suddenly I was presented an opportunity by a great guy called Jeremy Thomas, and it was more of a kind of a, what you would call these days, an acqui-hire. So we pretty much sold what we were doing and joined WebTrack. And WebTrack was very much a startup. I was the first employee. The other co-founder was a guy called Richard Evans, who used to do things like write algorithms for nuclear submarines to outrun each other through the gaps in radar, that kind of stuff. So he was...
So just a little bit of light code here and there, yeah.
Yeah, he was. I think he was a professor of information technology at Cambridge University, as I recall, and probably one of the top four Java programmers in the world back then. So anyway, so he was... So, you know, that's where that skill of learning how to code is actually be able to hold some form of conversation with... You know, you know, guys like who are just incredibly smart and incredibly, you know, deep into their field is important. Anyway, so I think probably the smartest thing I did is that we were very aligned with technologies. Java was something that we were, you know, working with and had experience with, and that's what their technology stack was. But they were very much focused on retail as a vertical. So they were basically doing. Helping with supply chain. So all of the tier one retailers around the world, so in here in Australia, your Mitre 10s, your Bunnings, your Coles, your Myers actually, you know, they have massive ERP systems, enterprise resource planning. So it's when you go and buy something from the point of sale, you know, it can kind of track and knows where to put, you know, big volumes of clothing, and you know, if there's a hot sale on red t-shirts, then they know how to scale up with red t-shirts, all that kind of stuff, all the stuff that Amazon's now doing really on steroids.
Yeah.
So so the smartest thing we did was actually sell to you know, those guys, and not only aligned with technology, but they'd already had experience. They weren't you know, kind of overly young people, but they'd sort of been on the back end of that technology burst. In the 80s, not internet, but kind of, you know, more kind of basic technology. So they had a very clear vision about what they wanted to achieve, which was awesome. So WebTrack ran for about 2 years. And then we got acquired by one of our partners called Retech, which is actually an Australian company.
Okay.
Originally founded in Melbourne. And so, you know, it was kind of an extraordinary journey, because we then became the catalyst for them to become a .com and become retail.com, and then IPO in the on the NASDAQ. So between 96 and 99, I essentially went from a two-person windowless office in Cambridge to, you know, my first trip to New York City was looking on, you know, hoteling in Times Square. And you know, there's retail.com splattered all over billboards, splattered all over cabs, splattered all over, you know, napkins in coffee shops, and just going, holy moly, how did this happen? So, so it was really exciting. So, yeah, you know, Retech was, although it was founded in Australia, it was actually based in Minneapolis, Minnesota, which is a bit of a retail hub. The Mall of America, still the largest mall in the US, is just outside of there. So I spent a lot of time in Minneapolis, and also, you know, kind of responsible for a lot of the European stuff as well. So that was super exciting. And, you know, I think we, you know, the dot-com boom, you know, we were on paper for a while. You know, we were paper millionaires for a couple of years, which was really exciting. But the good thing was is that we actually had a very robust model. We weren't like a, you probably know the name, like a boo.com,
which was
just a very flash in the pan. I remember actually having a few conversations and meetings with those guys, and they were just like, we were like, what are you even doing? So we were already very well established in the market. We, from a technology base, it wasn't all about being dot-coms, although that certainly, you know, sort of helped power us. So when things did start to, when the bubble did burst in around 2000, I think, we still had a very robust business model. So that, you know, that was kind of quite cool. So although we weren't, you know, millionaires to the degree on paper that we, you know, had hoped, we still did really well. And that business then eventually got acquired in the early 2000s, by Oracle, which then was still the second largest tech company after Microsoft, before you know, Google and Apple really took off. So that was a really exciting journey, going from pretty much a number of acquisitions, from literally just, you know, having some ideas, doing them, and riding this wave of sort of acquisitions. Was a really exciting time, you know, and one that will be with me for the rest of my life, I suppose.
You took your next step. That it sort of seems to be the next step went into sort of more the advertising and publishing space. Is that accurate?
The story is that I fell into marketing and advertising by mistake.
How did, as many of us do, mate? As many of us do. How did it happen for you?
Well, really, you know, it all sounds very sexy, but, you know, that whole dot-com time was a whole lot of really hard work. So, you know, for me personally, being on a plane and relationships and, you know, friends and feeling kind of like you're rooted to one place was actually quite hard. So, you know, I cashed out on a high, kind of did well, and I just wanted to have a break. And the best way that I could have a break, I thought, was move to Australia, live on Manly Beach, learn how to surf, dive, fly airplanes, sail boats. And then I thought, well, that's kind of cool, but also a bit dangerous. So I thought, well, the easiest way to stay ahead of things in technology was to do a master's degree. So I did a master's degree at UTS in Sydney, living on Manly. And that was kind of a really, you know, cool way to sort of rethink about what I wanted to achieve and what I wanted to do. You know, the retail space wasn't actually something that we chased after. We actually wanted to be a bit more of a, you know, a kind of a creative web dev shop.
Yeah.
But that's just what took us, you know, on that amazing journey. So, I did my master's degree in interactive media, and I thought, well, that was a good way of qualifying the fact that I'd actually started off in university doing a politics degree and making all of my experience.
Mate, I did the same.
Vaguely relevant.
Law and politics degree, and I look back on it and just go, what's that? I mean, it wasn't 3 years wasted, but it was 3 years wasted if you. Yeah. Anyway, I digress.
Yeah. I've got some views on universities and skills, but anyway, But, you know, it's still a university where it was a very, you know, enlightening era. And, you know, the fact that people were talking about things, about the internet academically was also quite exciting for me. So that was probably the left of field way of doing things, the way I got inspired. So, so landed in Australia. And Australia was absolutely a barren wasteland when it came to what was going on in digital. So, you know, you talk about dot-com boom and bust, you know, certainly we felt it in the UK and the US, but I think a lot of the big companies who were setting up shop here, like Microsoft, and using Australia as a very direct test market and plowing lots of money for in infrastructure and jobs and buildings, they pretty much left overnight. So, so that was kind of interesting. So when I actually did kind of start thinking about what I wanted to do, it was very hard to actually start contemplating doing something by myself, you know, being in a very new market, but also being in a very, you know, I guess competitive market for want of a better word.
Did you travel here on your own, or did you have family with you, or?
I've got family in Sydney. My dad actually lives in Sydney, so that was one of the reasons I wanted to, you know, reconnect and spend time with him and the family based here, and also New Zealand as well. So that was kind of cool. So yeah, I had a few friends already here as well. So from back home, so it was actually very easy to slot into Sydney life. You know, Australian life, Sydney life's just so awesome that it's. Yeah. You know, it's very easy to live here. And, you know, and at the same time, I fell in love with Australia. Also, I met my wife, you know, got married after a few years. And what I started to do after I was leaving university, I'd started exploring and doing some work with Sony Films and Animal Logic. Worked on a few of their big productions, you know, with the guys who did The Matrix. Matrix Turn 3 had just happened here. Star Wars, you know, the prequels had just happened here. So there was a lot actually happening in the, you know, in that kind of, in the creative film and media space. And I was already doing some work when I was doing my master's at UTS. So in particular, I was doing some work for Sony. So I applied for a job in advertising with one of the main agency groups, Havas, who had the Sony account, and started work for them as a contractor, and had lots of fun. We, you know, the first project actually won some big Admiral awards, which was pretty amazing. And actually, you know, it was the first time I actually saw a web page being featured in their TVC. So that was really cool. And the agency that I was involved with was doing some really amazing things at the time. So they were, you know, quite a hot agency.
Yeah.
And it was almost kind of a little bit like being in startup world, because you just do a lot of quick fire burst projects, as opposed to a lot of the, you know, by the time I left Retech, as they were sort of doing bigger jobs, you'd suddenly find that these projects would take months and months and months and months and months to sort of happen, which I kind of really wasn't used to. So being back into an environment that was very quick turnaround in media and advertising was actually quite exciting and quite rewarding. So I started playing the game of building my career in advertising. Ended up at places like MNC Saatchi and then a few integrated agencies. But then I kind of started thinking, well, actually a lot of these projects don't have, you know, that much substance. You know, an advertising campaign, an advertising website only has a certain amount of shelf life. So I just really yearned for getting back into deep tech. So ended up working for, I had a few guys who I sort of knew around the tracks, and some jobs were coming up for a company called Hiro, who were then the biggest, and in their heyday, I think probably the oldest as well, digital services company. They'd actually acquired a whole bunch of businesses. So they were doing things like Big Brother, Australian Idol, So kind of very media and sort of advertising, but, you know, really big builds. So, you know, there'd be $1 million build for doing a website. They were also doing a lot of stuff in mobile, which is really cool. So we built Telstra's network. We were doing some of those big builds for like Telstra and Foxtel.
Yeah. That would have been super early days of smartphones as well, wouldn't it? If it was,
it was pre-smartphones. So this was smartphone came out in 2008.
Right. Yep.
This was kind of 2006, 2007. So, but what we were doing with those Nokias, we were, you know, building the first apps inside things like the, you know, the N95, the last good Nokia. Mm. And so you could actually do your remote recording through your Foxtel IQ, which is actually the same technology that still they use today with a smartphone. So, and News Corp as well. So, and that's actually how I met my co-founder, Keith.
Yeah.
He was actually my client at News Corp because we were building out their, you know, their first mobile network, which was pretty cool. And still to this day, I think there's a lot of our tech that he and I worked on that's still, you know, still there 10 years later, so that kind of shows how good it is.
There's a lot more I could ask you about that advertising marketing, but I also sort of conscious that I want to make sure we talk about augmented reality, because obviously that's the space that you're in at the moment and that sort of current skill set. What did you think when you first saw, when did you first experience augmented reality?
I first, it was on a ski field in Japan.
Right.
When I actually had my first proper experience kind of out in the world. I've been tracking augmented reality for probably around 10 years.
Yeah.
Because on smartphones, they started becoming actually quite exciting, you know, the kind of some of the visual cues. So actually some of the early apps actually were, you know, kind of based on augmented reality as well. So, you know, one of the very first big famous ones on an iPad was the, you know, the Stargazer. So you can, you know, you hold it up to the sky and see some of the patterns and stars. That's augmented reality too. So, you know, that's kind of like the first kind of killer app, I suppose, with augmented reality. But I was skiing in Japan. I'd already sort of downloaded and started playing with some of the cool apps. Japan's always been a bit of a leader actually in augmented reality, which is interesting. And suddenly found myself, I was like, oh, I'm a bit lost. I don't know where I am. It's like, but I'm hungry. So I kind of
sound like an advert there, Dan.
Yes. that's the marketer at me. I was with my wife. We were kind of like, oh, not sure where we are. So I flicked open went, oh, you know what? I wonder if this app works. And lo and behold, I flicked it open and I kind of pressed the, you know, thing saying, you know, bars or restaurants. We're halfway up the mountain.
Yeah.
And suddenly, you know, the big arrow comes on screen, kind of crab ramen this way. And we're like, okay. Oh shit, that's good. That's sort of, you know, and we found probably the best, cheapest, most amazing crab ramen that I've ever eaten. And it was on the middle of a ski field in Japan. So that was my first, you know, kind of AR experience, if you like.
And how long ago would have that been?
That was probably about 10 years ago. That's probably 2009, 2010, something like that.
Okay. So have you always then had that sort of itch in the back of your head that AR was something that you wanted to do in those 10 years?
It probably comes back a number of steps further. I mean, I don't know about you. When I first flicked on the internet and my Netscape 1.0 browser, I was actually kind of pretty disappointed. It was all kind of gray and type, you know, font, and there was, you know, weren't that even many images. And I had this vision in my head, like Johnny Mnemonic or something, where it was this whooshy kind of 3D experience. So that's one of the reasons why I started learning VR ML, because I thought VR would be quite interesting and exciting. So it really comes back prior to them. I always thought there was more opportunity around sort of 3D visualization. So as things like AR came about, you know, started to happen on smartphones 10 years ago, it was always really interesting. So yeah, I've been, you know, the short answer to that, yeah, is I've been tracking it, and that's when because we also did a lot of work in film and a bit of gaming, so 3D is obviously kind of big there.
Yeah.
It just meant that when people like Apple made those kind of announcements, sort of saying, well, actually, you know, stuff that was usually took, you know, big chunks of hardware and reusing things like Xbox Kinect sensors, and we've crammed it all into a smartphone based on algorithms. That's where I kind of went, actually, this is quite a big deal now.
So there was a tipping point there when the hardware caught up with the software and the ideas that, you know, people were thinking.
Yeah, exactly. So a real breakthrough, you know, amazing.
Yeah.
And suddenly they launched it, and suddenly, you know, this level of AR with sensors and tracking was on 500 million devices around the world. That's pretty amazing.
So AR versus VR, obviously, you know, there's people that are out there that hopefully listening to this that are in marketing and they're, you know, and they're thinking, you know, should we be doing things in AR? Should we be doing things in VR? What sort of, that's part one of the question. Part two of the question is, what sort of industries do you think that whole AR, VR infrastructure suits?
It's a very good question. So I've just got back from literally a week and a half ago away from San Francisco and LA. So there's a lot of talk about exactly those questions there right now. So to answer the first question, the difference between AR and VR is essentially now AR means that it's just on a smartphone and in your pocket, whereas VR requires things like headsets and goggles and additional equipment. AR essentially just uses the camera in your smartphone or device to mix up, you know, put layers of computer-generated graphics into, you know, essentially a live video feed, right? So
yeah.
Imagine that Stargazer app. So you're looking at the sky and then it puts a layer through the camera of different constellations and the patterns of different constellations. So it's a very simple explanation. Whereas VR is, requires gear and headsets and stuff, basically. And it's also not immersive. It means that you're moving around physically a 3D world. So one of the, obviously being in LA, one of the big applications for this, you know, is in entertainment and movies.
Yeah.
And what they found, instead of having kind of, they started having things like VR suites inside cinemas and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But now they're actually moving to AR because it's great whilst you're, you know, if you want a pre-cinema or a post-cinema experience, they launched the latest blockbuster and they want to have, you know, kind of immersion in the cinema and go, great. Or you watch the movie, you come out and you kind of want to, you know, have a deeper relationship with Thor as a character, for instance. That's kind of okay. But for them, there's more, they figured out there's more longevity if it's actually on your personal device. So, you know, your iPhone or your iPad, you can actually take that home and have a deeper, longer experience from that entertainment, right? If that makes sense.
Yeah, it's a funny one because I don't see that. I love both sides of it, the AR and the VR side of things. But I feel that they're very, very different propositions for very different experiences.
Yeah, they are.
And I've used. I don't know if you've. I know you're based in Byron Bay. But there's a VR suite, for want of a better word, and it was actually a giant warehouse called Zero Latency in Brisbane.
Yeah, and I've met those guys. They're awesome.
Yeah, and I went there probably 2 months ago and just, you know, 45 minutes of just like, fucking hell, this was awesome. and I go, what makes it even more awesome for me was I go, this is first-gen technology. Like, well, you know, close to first-gen technology. So where is this going to be in 2 or 3 years' time or 5 years' time and that kind of thing? And I can see that you go with a group of friends and you know, we were killing zombies and all those kind of things. And you'd work the narrative together for 45 minutes, 60 minutes, that kind of thing. And you'd walk out and just go, wow, I was in another world. But I also get that the whole AR thing is that's more personal. You can take it home and those kind of things. It seems strange that they're shifting to AR from VR.
Yeah, I think that's just one example of the way that they've realized that one of the key advantages experience from one technology to the other. You know, I think there's actually quite a lot of confusion out there in the marketplace. So, you know, actually VR and AR are radically different things. It's, you know, they're one's fully immersive. It's just that they've got very similar acronyms and they both talk about reality. So after a while, we'll see that consumers in particular will start having a very much of a clearer picture between what the difference between the two things are actually. So we've actually, you know, in our messaging, we're actually trying to move away from even talking about AR too much and just talking about what the benefits are and actually what it does rather than what the technology is. So for us, it's been, you know, having that personal device, having that device that's always connected to you, it's a little bit like, you know, what's the best camera you've got? You know that saying,
and it's
the one that's in your pocket. And obviously, you know, more and more that means smartphones. So we're taking a similar approach with our platform and the way that we're approaching that.
Second part of that question was then, where do you think that the AR technology, what sort of other industries does that suit or work well with?
I mean, obviously gaming is massive. You know, even before AR kit last year, we saw Pokemon Go, which was, you know, a kind of a boom and bust overnight. But it was
I still see groups of them standing around in Brisbane.
Do you?
Yeah, absolutely. There's, for anybody that knows Brisbane, there's the road that I travel to go home, which is a road called Moggill Road, bizarrely splits into two and goes, you know, it goes round and then joins itself back up again, you know, just for like a few hundred metres, 300, 400 metres. And there's this embankment, grassy area in the middle of that. And I drove past the other day, probably 7 or 8 of them standing in a little group together.
There you are.
With their phones. You know, it was obvious that that they were playing Pokemon Go. But
yeah.
I just, they're still out there.
Are they still right now?
Well, I hope not, because that would have been about 3 weeks that they'd be stood there. But it was a very rare Pokemon if they are.
Yes, indeed.
I played it for about 24 hours, and of course all the servers weren't quite up to it. And yeah.
Yeah, same here. I kind of like, what's this all about? Oh, that's interesting. And then got very quickly disinterested.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. So, you know, there will be a lot of gimmicks and gadgets, and the way to sort of get people, you know, is innovation happens. So that's sort of fairly normal. I think, you know, getting back just to comparing our sector with the difference between AR and VR. VR, what I learned actually in the US was that for things like BIM, which is building information management, which is sort of the next iteration of doing CAD and 3D design, they're talking a lot more about using VR because it's fully immersive for actually designing buildings. So you can actually grapple with because you're designing a 3D object, a building in a 2D space. Typically, you know, it starts with floor plans and aspects, and then it goes to the 3D guys and they render it out and make it sort of, you know, into a 3D object. So they're a lot more serious about actually designing inside those immersive environments. So I think in terms of practical non-gaming sort of gimmicky applications, I think that's the area where VR will become quite interesting. So it's going to be a lot more of a kind of a business kind of driven thing rather than a consumer generated thing. I mean, if you think about people walking around and, you know, your zero latency is a great example. And you have a big warehouse running around shooting things and zombies wearing headsets. That's an awesome experience, but that's quite hard to sort of have in the workplace without justifying a practical application, right? So we think back to AR. We think that right here and now, having it on a smartphone and in your pocket is really exciting. Is it going to be the final interface? Is the smartphone touchscreen going to be the final interface for AR? There's a lot of debate around that by the industry, and we're all thinking probably not. But, you know, the same way that...
What do you think the final interface will be?
Well, I think you know, we'll see a lot more integrated hardware, you know, TV screens, thinking about voice control. You know, they'll certainly... Apple's just announced that they're going to, you know, they've patented some form of glasses, a little bit like Google Glass.
Yeah.
Google Glass was a failure mostly because the content behind it wasn't particularly interesting. It was sort of, you know, you didn't lose in, you know, you kind of lost interest after about a week. And Why would I do that instead of use my, just use my phone? But as we see things like, you know, the AI assistants kind of evolving and, you know, hardware evolving and, you know, some of these new innovations taking off, probably in about 10 years' time, I think, you know, we'll see some a deeper, the next iteration of what AR actually means. But for now, we think the AR experience on a smartphone and an iPad are key and pretty cool, and that's where a lot of the, you know, 3D mapping of the world will happen. I don't know if you've seen some of the really good stuff, the cool stuff that Google announced this week or last week. But there's some really cool AR tech that they're integrating with Google Maps.
Right.
Years ago they said, oh, you know what, we're going to map the outdoor world. And you were like, whatever. And they've done that. That's finished.
Yeah.
Now they've started mapping. They're going to start mapping, buildings. So, you know, you look at Manhattan or Brisbane on Google Maps and you can see a lot of the buildings actually, you know, kind of from an AR point of view are actually there. You know what I mean?
Okay.
So with that sort of stuff happening, it's suddenly going to become useful. It'll be like me being on my ski slope thinking, I'm hungry, give me something to eat. And, you know, it'll be that immersive and hopefully that seamless.
I love your comments about Google Glass. I think one of the things that I always said, and I've said multiple times in the past few years, is that essentially people don't like wearing things on their heads.
Mm.
And getting them to do that long term is a hard ask. You know, even, you know, people who actually use glasses for reading and sunglasses and things like that, it's not a, having something on your head like that is not a, it's not a long-term wish.
Mm.
So to be consistently walking around for 8 hours a day with a set of Google glasses on, it's not something that people are willingly wanting to do. So the benefits have to vastly outweigh the negatives of having to put those on there. And even you go, what are the benefits that something like that could possibly offer me that would outweigh the reason for having it on for 8 hours a day?
Yeah.
And I can't see that at the moment. Again, maybe in an industrial or an business environment, maybe I could see that. But yeah.
I totally agree. And I was very cynical when, you know, Google Glass launched. I didn't rush out and want to buy them. In fact, I mean, you know, Google always said it was more of an R&D project anyway. It was very actually hard to buy them. You had to sit on a waiting list. So I totally agree. I mean, I guess sort of answering your question again into other industries, automotive, self-driving cars,
absolutely.
You know, head-up displays are, you know, kind of a big area. We strongly believe real estate is going to be huge. You know, our thesis is pixels are cheaper than bricks, right? So trying to visualize, you know, and selling dirt is hard. So if you're trying to buy or sell a house off the plan, it's very, there's actually a word that I learned in in the US called aphantasia, which is a brilliant word. Which basically is the inability for people to visualize. So anyone who struggles to visualize and they're looking to buy a house off the plan, which relies on, you know, 2D plans and people sort of pointing up in the air and saying, imagine this tree line, that's not going to be there. And imagine this, that's not going to be there. And imagine your living room here. They just go cross-eyes and balk and walk away from the deal, right? Yeah. So what we're trying to do is just by, again, having a smartphone, actually being able to walk around a house in full size so you can actually stand in your living room and look outside and see what the view is, then you can connect with it, right? Rather than just rely on, you know, bits of paper or web pages, which are essentially just, you know, 2D renders of a picture.
I must have saw it on LinkedIn the other day, and I actually should have tagged you in it because I saw a fit-out company, a restaurant fit-out or a bar fit-out company that were building the fit-outs out of cardboard and putting them in the space to allow the client to be able to visualize how the thing looks. And that seemed to me to be a giant waste of cardboard.
Yeah.
When you've got AR out there, and I'm going, you know, those people really should be talking to you because, you know, being able to visualize the fit out, I think it was so that they could stand there and they could work out, you know, service capabilities, how many people you could get behind a bar, you know, whether they would be constantly bumping into each other, those kind of things.
Yeah, exactly. But exactly again, right.
That's another use for the, you know, the platform. Do you think there's going to be much gain? Do you think there's much more gaming to come in the AR space?
It's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I don't actually pay a lot of attention. I'm not an active gamer anymore myself. So
what did you play?
Oh, I think probably Call of Duty and those.
We had Mike Goldman on here the other day. He was watching Call of Duty on Twitch the other day. So right. I used to play an insane amount of Call of Duty, but that's, anyway.
It's a bit embarrassing these days being a 45-year-old and still playing with your PlayStation.
Do you know what? It's embarrassing being a 45-year-old and not being good at it. It's not embarrassing if you're 45 years old and you're shit hot at Call of Duty. No, yeah. Anyway.
Well, I have my son in the UK, so he is very good at, he just kicks my ass when we do the, you know, online gaming. So that's one reason I still play. So yeah, but then I kind of feel okay with that because then I kind of go, well, actually I remember I'm not wasting my life in front of playing Xbox.
I sold mine years ago. And my wife said recently, a couple of years ago, she goes, you can buy another one if you want. And I just went, it's just such a time sink. And
it is.
I'm like, you know, and the problem is I don't want to play Call of Duty and be shit at it. I want to play Call of Duty and be good at it, which means that's even more of a time sink involved. And, you know, there's nothing worse than, you know, kids on the other side of the world who are 13 years old shooting you and then having a go at you across the, you know, across the internet. And I'm like, no.
That's right.
If I'm going to do this, I have to do it properly. So that's why I thought, no, I'm not going to buy another one. So
that's right. Very obsessive, compulsive.
Brilliant. Oh,
but I should say, I mean, not that, you know, we all talk about Oculus Rifts and the new Vivas and all those kind of VR headsets, and actually the Sony PlayStation VR headset is probably the biggest VR gaming platform, probably the biggest VR platform out there. So it would be remiss not to mention that.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's next for you guys? Where does Realer go after, you know, establishing itself in the marketplace for that sort of, you know, building, construction, real estate?
Well, we've been bootstrapping this, which basically means we've been, you know, building a minimal viable product for the last 6 months, which we're really happy with. And there's some cool, you know, we've got some great IP in there. We've got an app that's live in their marketplace. Next few weeks we'll have Google Android as well. So that gives us an even bigger reach. Yeah. For us, it's going to be growing and focusing on our market here in Australia, and then with a view of scaling up to the US straight away. because the US market is very similar in terms of structure to the Australian market, we think that's quite exciting. So actually, Australia is a really, really great place for us to learn and bootstrap. And, you know, even though sometimes I'm mocked for being in Byron Bay,
who mocks you for being in Byron Bay, Dan?
Lots of people who want to live in Byron Bay usually. We're in actually an amazing area. So there's a lot of land release corridors in northern New South Wales and especially southeast Queensland, just below Brisbane. And that's actually very similar to what's happening in a lot of similar areas around like LA County and Chicago and those kind of things as well, because it's an important human problem. We're running out of houses versus population growth and especially the affordability, right? So, and you know, a first-time home buyer is looking at a 400 grand mortgage, which is pretty, which is huge. And so trying to solve that problem of visualizing and not balking is quite important to us. So that's sort of our, that's probably going to be our focus for the next 6 to 12 months, is really growing our business and growing our customer base in Australia, New Zealand, and of course the US. But then we're also thinking about widening, you know, our business plan is to go a little bit deeper into the consumer space. So we really want to take this technology as it evolves. And we're also sort of sitting on the hills a little bit. So if you look at some of the Google stuff that announced last week, so that's actually something we can leverage. So we want to ride on the coattails of that and let Google do a lot of the education around what this sort of technology can do. And so it's a lot easier sell for us to go, well, you know, that Google thing that you use now every day that finds your crab ramen in a ski field. Well, we can do that, but we can now apply that to a, you know, real estate space. So, you know, for example, with more residential homes and that kind of thing. So that's our goal. But we're a startup, so we're very focused on the here and now, which is growing our customers, making our customers happy, which is great. We've got an online proposition, so people can just go to realed.com and, you know, basically pay as little as $25 to upload a model. We can even do model conversions now, which is actually quite exciting. So people can actually just send us 2D models and we can convert it into 3D without a lot of a lot of the pain, even if you use things like SketchUp as opposed to 3D Studio Max or Revit or Maya or any of the other big packages. So it's exciting times for us.
You're also involved in some other startup stuff. Is there anything else that you work on in those spaces, or is that just sort of, this is now you're 100% into Realer?
Yeah, so this came through our incubator accelerator that's based in Byron Bay called Startino. That's been operating for 4 years. So I really wanted to take a lot of the startup community that was happening in Sydney, which is where I was obviously based. And I was just actually in Brisbane for Myriad last week as well. Yep. And there's a great startup community there too. In fact, I'd probably say a little better integrated with the regions. There's some fantastic people up there. I really wanted to activate, our community, the Byron community, even though it's a small kind of sleepy surf town, has actually got the highest density of creative industries outside of Sydney and Melbourne. So I really wanted to kind of inject some of the startup stuff and co-working infrastructure. Community started to mature. There's lots of co-working spaces now in Byron, which is great. Means I'm not the only one hollering, come to Byron and co-work. As our community is evolving in terms of startups, we're seeing a lot more traction there. So I think it's important that any startup community is focused on co-founders and driven by co-founders, which is the similar model to the US. So I think it's important for us, as the startup community, to go back and do startups. So to answer your question, yes, fully focused on Realer. We're operating out of the hub in Byron, which is pretty much self-sustaining and well-established now. And, you know, and of course I do still, you know, help and talked to some of the other incubator and accelerator businesses that have come through our hub, which is really cool.
Anything coming out of what would be your one thing coming out of Byron that you've seen sort of recently or, you know, last year or so that you think people should keep an eye on, a new business, a startup that's coming out of Byron?
There's always a lot happening at various different levels, you know. So we've got Spell Designs, one of the, you know, hot fashion labels. We've got, you know, Tripadeals. There's a lot of travel and tourism, obviously. But I think there's some really cool stuff happening in out of the food industry. So there's a lot of agritech, and there's a lot of, you know, food brands coming out there. So actually, one that I'll mention is called Yumbar, yumbar.co. They do vegan ice cream.
Okay.
And I'm not a, I'm a kind of, I think we do eat too much meat. I'm not a fully fledged vegan. I'll put my hands up to that straight away. But these bars are absolutely incredible.
Okay.
You know, not only are they ethically good, but they taste fantastic. Yeah. They're like nothing you've ever eaten before. So I'm quite excited about that because that business has been, you know, we've been working with them and they've now just opened a new commercial factory and facility. So they're going to be scaling up a lot wider across not only Australia, but hopefully overseas soon. So keep an eye on that one.
Last question. If anybody wants to reach out and say hello to you, what's the best way of them getting in contact with you?
Just go through relay.com. There's a contact page. But if they want to, most of that stuff comes through directly because we're still small and growing.
Yep.
So that's the best way. Go to realair.com.
You're also on LinkedIn?
Yep. Yeah. Also on LinkedIn as well. So hit me up there and then you can find me and, you know, obviously DM me.
Cool. Mate, it's been absolutely fantastic. Thank you very much for your time. It's been really interesting hearing about what's going on in a world that I think a lot of people are nervous about, or perhaps a little bit you know, wary of, that they don't quite understand it. It's because it's, even though it's been about for 10 years, it's still such early days for it. So
yeah,
it's fantastic getting your ideas and your input as well. So thank you very much for coming on the show.
A real pleasure, Simon. Thanks for the great questions. Really fun time. Cool. Thanks.
Thank you, mate. Cheers.
Take care. Bye.
That's it for the Simon Dell Show, episode 29. Thank you very much for tuning in. We look forward to you coming back next week. Thank you.